whether we like it or not, when I give my body to another person in sexual intimacy, I am saying to that person, I'm giving you myself. I'm giving you my entire life. Everything that is mine is yours.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. On today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber begin discussing the important topic of sexuality. In our modern world, few topics produce as many questions or as much debate as sexuality. We need to understand sexuality from a biblical perspective. We need a biblical theory of sexuality. Here now are Jack and Christine.
There have been lots of times over the last several weeks and months that we've said, we're going to talk about sexuality. Just wait, it's going to come in the future. And so finally here today, we're going to begin our series on sexuality. I don't think either of us know how long it's going to go, but I imagine it will go several weeks. We're going to start out talking about a biblical theory of sexuality, just to lay a foundation so that people can understand where we're coming from and we can build on that. After that, we're going to talk about biblical sexual ethics. We're going to talk about how do I view myself as a sexual person in my marriage, and how do I view myself as a sexual person as a single person, and try and get real practical. Today, we're going to talk about how should we as Christians approach the question of how to live as a sexual person.
As Christians, and what I mean by Christians when I say that, I assume that's what you mean, people that are committed to the authority of the Bible and are seeking to order their lives in the light of what the Bible teaches, how we are going to think about sexuality will be radically different from the way most of our culture thinks about sexuality.
How does most of our culture think about sexuality?
Well, if you were to go to an anthropology professor at the university, probably that anthropology professor would tell you that marriage is a man-made institution, something that over the course of the evolution of the human species developed as a way of channeling our sexuality and handling it and dealing with it and controlling it. That is what's given is that we are biologically sexual creatures. That's a given, and we've got these drives and we've got these impulses that we have to deal with. They could be really destructive if it engenders a lot of warfare and jealousy and so on. And so we created marriage to be the rules that we all play by so that we can be reasonably civilized people in dealing with our sexuality. That's kind of the story an anthropologist would tell you, I think.
Okay, so what he would say is that marriage is really kind of a way to put a boundaries or a limitation on our sexuality.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that's the academic anthropologist, but I think if you were to look at anybody in our culture, their view is going to be based on that theory of our sexuality, namely that it's a man-made institution, something that we invented. And therefore, since we invented it, we could always reinvent it. And so you can, you know, you've seen the newspaper articles, the changing face of marriage or something like that, where they go and interview people who have a newfangled open marriage, where people live together in a sexual relationship, but they invite one another to be pursuing sexual relationships with other people at the same time. And the concept is, look, we're changing our attitudes about marriage. We're changing how we define it. We're changing how we think about it. Isn't that interesting that we're changing what marriage is for us? Or group marriages, where you have three or four or five or six people who are mutually spouses of one another. That's a new way of thinking about marriage. Well, why do we even permit ourselves to think that way? Because our basic underlying attitude is, this is something that we as people have invented, and if we don't like the way it's gone so far, then we can reinvent it and make it something different, make it something new.
So if it really wasn't designed by God, if it was designed by man, why don't we redesign it?
Exactly.
Why don't we just do something different with
right.
it? So it's not based on what's right or wrong. That really isn't a part of the equation at all. It's just based on kind of what do we feel like doing today.
Right.
Because we invented this because we felt like doing marriage in the way we have traditionally for many years. Now we feel something different, so let's go for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So as people who believe in God and in the Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, and believe in the authority of the Bible, we have a very, very different perspective on that. And specifically, our view is that there is a creator God who not only was the power behind creation, but was sort of the mind behind creation, the architect, the designer of the created order, and that he had something very specifically in mind when he created human beings to be sexual beings. He had a purpose in mind. There was a design to it. There was a function of our sexuality. It's not just this given that we can do with whatever we want to. It's a fact of our being that was intended to serve a certain role and a certain function in our lives. So
it definitely has a certain purpose, just like our eyes have a purpose. They're not meant to drink water. They're meant to see. So sexuality was designed for a particular purpose.
Right. And that's going to become important in all of my thinking later on, the whole idea that there is such a thing as a natural order. There is such a thing as laws of nature. There's such a thing, therefore, as what we would call natural laws. And what I will argue is that from a biblical point of view, it's important that we not violate the natural laws. We are rebelling against God's architectural design. If we decide, you know, I really don't like the way you designed this, God, I'm going to redesign it for you. That's a rebellious sort of position. It's an ungodly and evil attitude, not one that the Bible would condone.
So it seems to me, Jack, if the universe is set up by natural laws that we're not to break, we really need to know what those are.
Right.
Are you going to be talking about those?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yeah. We'll be talking about those natural laws that we can discover that apply to our sexuality.
At this point, Jack, let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about the biblical view of marriage. What are some of the natural laws that got us designed around sexuality?
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
Before the break, Jack, you were saying that God really has made a design for our sexuality that is very specific and that we need to understand in order to approach our sexuality appropriately. Righteously. What is God's design for sexuality? What's the biblical understanding of sexuality?
Well, in general terms, I think one of the first things we need to see is that God has created sexuality, human sexuality, and I make a distinction because I don't think animal sexuality is the same thing as human sexuality, or more importantly, that human sexuality is the same thing as animal sexuality. I think they are radically different things.
So we can't look at nature, at the way the animal world works, and say, here's a model for ourselves.
Yeah, that would be a huge mistake, to go out and look at the way animals mate and then think that's what we're supposed to do. That would lead us way, way off God's design.
So real briefly, why is that so? Because I can imagine that people think, well, that really is a good picture of the way we're supposed to respond to one another.
Well, fundamentally, it'll be clearer as I kind of go through what I think is a biblical theory. It'll be clearer why that's the case. But in brief, it's because animals don't get married. And what I'm going to argue is that God created human sexuality to serve the purposes of the marriage commitment. Sexuality is for marriage. It's not that marriage is for sexuality. That's what our culture says. That's what the anthropologist says, is that man created marriage because it's a given that we are sexual beings. What I'm going to argue is that God has created sexuality because it's a given that God created man and woman to be married to one another. And to serve the purposes of that marriage relationship, he created sexuality to be a tool for men and women to use in sealing their commitment, in celebrating their commitment, in ratifying their commitment, and in communicating their commitment to one another. And that's what sexuality is for. Sexuality is to help in the pursuit of the marriage commitment.
Okay, so let me just review that for a minute, because there's quite a distinction that you're making here. We're saying that sexuality is designed by God for marriage. Our culture says sexuality is designed by man for marriage.
The other way around. Our culture says that marriage is created by man for sexuality.
Sexuality.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, you could probably outline the differences in three ways. Who designed it? Our culture says man has designed marriage. The Bible says God has designed marriage. There's the question of the priority. That our culture would say sexuality is the given and has priority. Marriage only serves the purposes of sexuality, whereas the biblical view is that marriage has the priority. That's the given, and God created sexuality to serve the purposes of marriage. And then the third thing is human sexuality the same as animal sexuality or not? Our culture would say ultimately yes. The Bible would say definitely not.
Okay. Okay. So what is God's design for marriage? What is marriage about? Let's talk about that first and then understand sexuality from our understanding of marriage.
We need to talk about marriage because if I'm right that sexuality is serving the purposes of marriage, we have to understand what marriage is in order to understand how sexuality serves the purposes of marriage.
Exactly.
Yeah, I take my cues from Genesis where the text says, and therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And it looks to me there like there's two aspects to the relationship that a man is supposed to forge with a woman. One is that he leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, which I take to mean that he forsakes any other human loyalty, for example, his loyalty to his parents. He forsakes any other human loyalty to put his wife in the position of highest loyalty. He's loyal to her above and beyond his loyalty to any other human being on the face of the earth. And so putting his wife in that place of specialness where he communicates to her that she is valuable, that she is uniquely valuable, that she is treasured, that she is cherished, meets a very deep emotional need in her, and I think this is reciprocal. The wife does the same thing for the husband. So they meet a very, very deep psychological need in one another to be significant, to be valued, to be treasured, to be important. And they do that by making a commitment to make one another that special person to one another and to grant that kind of loyalty to one another. And then the other aspect of it is the two will become one flesh, that they are committing to one another to not ever leave one another behind in their experience with life. They're going to do life together, not separately, not independently. They're going to do life in parallel. And what that means, I think, is not that they literally do everything together, as we've talked about this in the past. It's not that they literally have to do everything together, but they have to have such a regard for the experience of the other person that they want to know what one another's experience of life is like. They want to understand it. They want to connect with it. They want to involve themselves with it in such a way that they can, if at all possible, understand life from inside that person's head. And that's, I think, what he means by becoming one flesh.
And we've also made the distinction that in becoming one flesh, I am respecting the otherness of the other person. I'm not trying to make them like me. I'm trying to understand who they are. And so in becoming one, we're both unique individuals, both really committing ourselves to understand really the uniqueness of the other person.
Yeah, precisely.
And it is in that understanding that we're becoming one, not in trying to remake the other person to be like me.
Precisely, yeah.
So given that understanding of marriage, how does sexuality fit into it?
To explain that, I have to explain a concept that will be important here, and that's the concept of natural language. The one who really helped me understand this is a Scottish philosopher named Thomas Reid. He's not a particularly well-known philosopher, but he should be better known than he is, because I think he really had some brilliant and profound insights. Thomas Reid argued that the way in which we understand what the world out there outside of me is like is that, in effect, that world speaks to me. It speaks to me in a language that God has just built into my brain, into my being. For example, if I walk into a room and wafting across the air of the room is this fragrance, and I know there's a rose here somewhere, because through experience I've learned that fragrance is correlated with that object out there in the world that we call a rose. What's going on there? And what he's arguing is the way to understand that is that fragrance is the language that is built in, whereby I learn to associate the meaning of that fragrance with that object that we call a rose, in the same way that the English word G-O-L-D, gold, means that ore that you find in the ground. Just as a written word, a verbal device like G-O-L-D means the ore in the ground, that fragrance means the presence of that object, the rose.
So this is a universal language that he's talking about. In China, I have a different word for rose, but in China, I still smell the rose.
Exactly.
The same as somebody in the United States would smell it.
Right. And so what Reid is saying is that English is an artificial language. That is, we did invent the English language. Through the course of time, it evolves and develops and so on. We have to learn it from our parents. We have to learn it from our culture. It's not built in. Our ability to learn artificial languages is built in, but the artificial language that we use, like English, is something that we have to learn. We don't have to learn to use our natural language. It's just God-given. It's hardwired in to my very being. I have to, through experience, learn that fragrance goes with that flower, the rose.
I have to learn to name it.
I have to learn to name it.
But I don't have to learn that there's a smell there.
And particularly, yeah, exactly. And I don't have to learn that the smell means there's an object corresponding to it. I don't have to learn that.
Okay, so how does all this fit into our sexuality, Jeff?
Well, what I would argue is that the only way to really understand what the Bible is saying about the ethics of sexuality is to understand that the Bible assumes sexuality is a natural language as well. That is built into us. God has built in, hardwired into my psyche, the fact that sexual intimacy with another person actually means something. It's communicating something. And because it's communicating something, I can lie with sexuality. I can tell a lie. I can say something with my body that I'm not, in fact, ready to follow through with in the rest of my life. And that would be wrong. That would be a falsehood, a lie, a deception.
Okay, so what you're not saying is sexuality is a natural language in the sense that we should understand just intuitively how to be sexual people. Or how to act sexually. That's not what you're saying
here. No,
no. And I think people might have jumped to that. I did for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying is, what's hardwired into us is the reality that sex means something. We are communicating something, even if we deny we're communicating it, through being sexual with another person. Just as the smell of the rose communicates that there's a rose out there. I can't change that reality. It just is true.
Right.
That's what you're saying.
Exactly. And specifically, what sexual intimacy means, and this is probably oversimplifying, but to oversimplify, what it means is I'm giving my life to you.
That my sexual partner, I'm giving my life, my marital partner, I'm giving my life to you by being sexual with you.
Well, and even in a sense more importantly, anyone that I am sexually intimate with, what I'm saying to that person is I'm promising my life to you. Whether I am or not is a whole other question. That's where ethics comes in. Is it possible to say that I'm giving my life to someone and then go, wrong, I'm not? I can certainly do that, but how ethical is that? How kind is that? How loving is that? How right is that? It's not right. And that's where the biblical sexual ethic comes from. That's why in the biblical sexual ethic, sexuality has no place outside of marriage. Why? Because it's only in marriage where what I am saying with my body, I am also promising with my words and every other part of my life to follow through with that. I promise with my body I'm going to give you my life, and then I do. In the rest of my life, I give you my life. I put you as that person that I make the most special person, I grant the unique loyalty to, and I pursue a life of connecting with you and becoming one flesh with you. Only in that context am I following through to keep my promise. Sexuality outside of marriage, I say one thing with my body and then I walk away. And I treat the person in a way that's completely incompatible with what I have promised them, even if I say I have not promised them. What I'm arguing is, I have promised it to them anyway, even if I didn't intend to, because sexuality just does mean that to one another. Whether we like it or not, it means that I'm giving my life to you.
It just does mean that to one another. It may not be exactly accurate. Might we say it just does mean that according to God? God has designed it to mean that, even if we deny its meaning, it still exists as that.
Yeah, although let me argue with that a little bit. Not only according to God, but according to nature. And what I mean by that is, it's not just that God intended it to mean this, but we could intend it to mean something else. I think ultimately we can, through our experience, just kind of brutalize our own psyches and batter ourselves into disassociating our sexuality from what it means. I mean, I think we can disconnect our sexuality from ourselves. I think that's true, and I think there are people that do that. But in doing that, they really have to break themselves. They really have to break something inside of themselves. And they really do have to disconnect something that naturally was connected. Namely, their sexuality and their very lives. In their psyche, they go together. And most people don't make that disassociation or that disconnection really all that easily. And that's why you have so much literature and music, the lyrics of popular music in particular, where they're struggling with the use of their sexuality. And how many times do you see these lyrics wrestling with the sense of betrayal and loneliness and isolation and resentment and bitterness because somebody who was sexually intimate with them walked away from them?
So on one hand, I can say, I could really have sex with anybody I want and do that. But when I do that, if I haven't completely dissociated myself from my sexual being, from my psyche, from who I am, who God made me, then I just am going to feel the consequences of breaking how I was made.
Right.
And the consequences are like in feeling rejected, in feeling lonely, in feeling betrayed. I intuitively know that there's something really wrong with this.
Yeah, think of a scene that you've probably seen in a movie like this where it could be a man or a woman, but let me just make it a man, where a man seduces a young woman or basically gets a young woman to become sexually intimate with him, and the young woman reaches over and takes a drink of his Coke the next morning, and the man responds, "Cut that out, that's mine." And the woman is taken aback because, you know, why would she be taken aback? Why would that seem incongruous to her? The reason it seems incongruous is because last night you promised me your entire life, and this morning you won't give me a drink of your Coke. That the incongruity there is never lost on us. I think even people who have brutalized their psyches, even they cannot disassociate sexuality from its meaning so far that they don't see the incongruity of something like that. What do you mean you'll give me your body and you won't give me your Coke? That is just crazy. Because it seems to me that the way God has created our sexuality is you cannot get more intimately me than my body, and particularly my genitals, the sexual erotic part of my body, or the sexual erotic aspects of my body. That is as far as my own psyche is concerned, that's about as close to me as anybody can get.
That's as vulnerable a part of me as there is.
Exactly. Therefore, if I am willing to give my sexual being, the erotic me, my genitals, if I'm willing to give someone intimate knowledge and intimate physical contact with my genitals and the erotic me, that there ought to be nothing about my life that I am willing to withhold. I mean, it's the argument of the greater or the lesser. If I am willing to give you the greatest part of me, certainly everything that is mine and everything that I have and everything associated with me, I am willing to share with you. So when we don't follow through on that, when all of a sudden we become possessive of my Coke, after having given freely of my body, everything in me screams, this is crazy. Because you told me with your body last night that you were promising everything. You told me you were promising me your life. So why on earth are you withholding your Coke?
Now, Jack, I really understand that you think that way. That you can't imagine that somebody couldn't make that connection. You gave me your body, so why wouldn't you give me the Coke? But I really can imagine that a lot of people would say it doesn't follow at all. I gave my body, and that's really separate from giving my Coke. And I think that's because we really have dissociated our bodies. And what we mean by dissociation is kind of split ourselves off one part from the other, created a real wall between or distinctions between different parts of ourselves. My sexuality becomes something that's very different, for example, than my emotional person. For many people, being emotionally intimate is a great deal more intimate than being sexually intimate.
Right.
And they'd far prefer becoming sexual with somebody, or many, many people, than to share emotional details or emotional vulnerability in their life. In fact, it seems far safer to many people. And I think that's what we've done in our culture. We've made a shift. And that's why I think what we're talking about today is probably very difficult to really get our arms around. What we're saying today is sexuality is intended to be by God and how God created it in nature, to be the most vulnerable part of ourselves. It is the place from which we can share ourselves most completely. But that's not what our culture has done with it. We've made it a vehicle of pleasure. And that isn't a place of vulnerability necessarily. It's a place where we feel erotic, where we feel aroused, sex is, in a sense, kind of become like a drug, something that makes us feel good, and it's a very powerful drug. And it really has nothing to do with our vulnerability. It doesn't have anything to do with me, who I am, my being, my psyche. And what we're saying today is radically different than that. It does have to do with who we are. In fact, that's what it is.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm not at all suggesting that there is not an experience out there where people have managed to think of their sexuality differently. But what's important is to see that it's unnatural, it's broken, it's ultimately perverse to think of my sexuality that way. And it's not the way we were designed or created.
If you've appreciated these discussions between Jack and Christine, you won't want to miss Mackenzie Study Center's upcoming spring conference in Eugene, Oregon. Jack and Christine will be joined by marriage and family therapist Larry Barber, Christine's husband, and Mackenzie Study Center teacher Nancy Scott for a conference entitled Sexuality and Relationships, A Biblical Perspective. The conference will take place on April 3rd and 4th and will feature such topics as biblical sexual ethics, loving responsibly, and dealing with our brokenness. Panel discussions and ample time for audience interaction will accompany each of four sessions. The goals of the conference are to clearly present and openly discuss the biblical foundations of sexuality and to develop a practical picture of how to live in light of the biblical view. If you would like to know more about this unique conference and the cost to attend, please call us at 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. More information will be given at the end of the program on how you can contact Mackenzie Study Center. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Before the break, we were talking about what is sexuality in marriage? What purpose does it have? The purpose it has is that I am committing myself, I am saying, by being sexual with my marriage partner, or with anyone, that I'm committing myself to you. That is just the language of sex. I'm saying that I'm committing myself to you, and I'm communicating that commitment to you through being sexual with you.
You know, what I'm arguing is that that's the purpose of sexuality as God designed it. Unlike the animals, the purpose of sexuality in the animals is procreation. Its purpose is to make little deer and dogs and cats and...
Bunnies,
yeah. That's its purpose. Mm-hmm. And so... when animals mate, they aren't making any promises to one another. They're just making it possible for the species to go on. That's not what's happening among humankind. Granted, sexuality, one aspect of sexuality is also its correlation with reproduction. It's the way other human beings come into the world. And it's not insignificant that God created it that way. It's not insignificant that God made new human beings come into the world and be nurtured by people who have a marriage commitment to one another, a lifelong marital commitment to one another. That's no accident, I think. I think clearly that's by God's design. But it's different to say that God has appropriately put reproduction together with sexuality and to say that the purpose of our sexuality is reproduction. Those are two entirely different things. In the animal kingdom, maybe I'm showing my ignorance here, but it seems to me that at least with a lot of animals, the male animal is not even particularly interested in mating with the female animal, except when the female can conceive. When a dog is in heat, the male is interested. If the dog is not in heat, the dog is not interested. Because procreation is the whole point of mating in the animal kingdom. In human sexuality, there's always a potential interest in sexuality among human beings. It doesn't seem to be fundamentally linked to a reproductive cycle or a cycle of fertility. Why is that? I think because sexuality is a whole entirely different thing among human beings. It's not for procreation exclusively. It's for this communication that can go on between two people who have a lifelong commitment to one another. I think I've used the language earlier. It's a way of celebrating that commitment. It's a way of ratifying that commitment. It's a way of sealing that commitment. Just as it's important at times to say to my wife, I love you, sexuality is another really dramatic and poignant and meaningful way of saying to one another, not only I love you, but even more importantly, I give you my very being. I give you everything.
I give you myself.
I give you myself.
And I'm going back to the word that I've used previously, but I am so vulnerable in that position, Jack. I'm not just giving an impression of myself. I'm not rightly done, rightly understood. If I really am communicating what we're talking about through my sexuality, if I'm really understanding it and giving it in this way, then I'm saying to you that I'm very, very open to you, that I'm giving you my innermost being, the most of what I have. I'm not just giving you an impression of me that I want you to have. I'm not just saying, here's an overview, a surface view of who I am, but here is, at the depths of my being, who I am. I'm expressing that through my sexuality. Now, I certainly don't have to do that. I can certainly make it a surface thing. But as God intended it, it is to be something, a vehicle to expose myself to another person. I think going back to why are we married, what does my marriage vow imply? It implies that I am making you, I'm communicating to you that you're the most special person, and I'm giving the most special part of me to tell you that.
Right, right. In fact, I like to look at it this way. I mentioned I like to think of the Genesis account as giving us sort of two aspects of the marriage commitment. One is becoming one flesh, and one is this sense of being the most special person in my life. Let's take sexuality the way the Bible presents it, according to the ethic that the Bible recommends to us. On the one hand, when I am giving my body, as we've been suggesting, I'm really promising my entire life, my prior existence. In other words, I'm promising to become one flesh with you. Nothing that is mine will I withhold from you. If I will give you my very body itself, then there is nothing that is mine that is not yours. And that's communicating the one fleshness of marriage. But I'm also communicating how special the other person is with this qualification, if I am operating according to a biblical sexual ethic where I only have sex with my wife or husband, with my spouse, and I don't give sexual knowledge of myself to anybody else. If that's the case, then sexuality, sexual intimacy, is something that God has put into my hands to be able to communicate dramatically to my wife or husband, no one else in the world is as special to you as I am, because I won't sleep with anybody else. You are the only person that I will give sexual intimacy to. Now, I say it's a tool that he's put in our hands, because what else do I have that I can righteously do that with? According to the commandment to love my neighbor, I can't reserve my time for only my spouse or my money or my any of my possessions. I mean, what is there that I have that I could righteously withhold from anybody in the world, but I will give it to my spouse and only my spouse? I don't think there's anything. I need to be free with every human being, with my time and my energy and my material resources and so on. I need to be generous and open-handed with everybody. But the unique thing about sexuality is not having sex with my neighbor is not depriving my neighbor of anything that I ought to be giving them, anything that they need, anything that they have to have.
Or anything they should have.
Anything that they should have. I'm not being unloving if I withhold sexuality from them. And therefore, sexuality is something that I can reserve to be a unique relationship that I have with my wife or husband. And therefore, is it a very important way of making the statement to them, no one else in the whole world is like you. No one else will I give this to.
So the question that comes to mind to me, Jack, is, so why don't we really see it as that unique? And a couple of ideas come to mind for me. One is, we've made sex so casual in our culture.
Right.
When I'm dating someone, I can basically, in my culture, kiss the other person, hold hands with the other person, touch the other person's genitals, be involved with them, with intercourse, in any sexual way I want to. And so we've come to take away the real gift that sexuality is to my marriage partner. We've made it something that we can do with anybody. And so to understand what you're talking about, we really have to go outside our culture and look at it from a purely biblical perspective.
Right.
And that's a hard thing to do, but I would really challenge people who are listening to try and do that. Let's take ourselves out of our culture for a minute and just understand what God intended it to be. Also, Jack, I think we've turned things around. what the Bible says and what you're arguing is, sex is the only thing that I can righteously withhold from another person. Absolutely right. However, that's not how we do it again in our culture. I think I'm right to withhold my money. I think I'm right to withhold my time, my possessions, my, even my spouse. We have gotten in our culture a real sense of selfishness, of withholding from other people. This is mine, and here's my fence around it. In the psychological community, we hear a lot about limits and boundaries. And rightly understood, I think it's really important to have boundaries and to have limits. But wrongly understood, and I think often it is wrongly understood, we put boundaries around things that really should not have boundaries. We have become selfish people that are withholding from other people much of who we are and what we should give. And we have become unrighteous people who don't get it. We've turned the whole thing around. So what we should be able to clearly understand, what you're saying is, it really rings a bell to me. But to get there is kind of a long journey, given where our culture is at.
Yeah, we have to be willing to radically critique our culture and the whole history of our own attitudes toward our sexuality. We have to subject them to a radical critique and decide, wait, I've got to go back to the drawing board. Why am I who I am, and what does God want me to do with that? And if we're not prepared to do that, we're lost.
We really do have to do the work, Jack, because you and I are not going to be understood here unless people are willing to do that.
Yeah.
Because if we blend what we're saying into our culture, it will not really make any sense. The unique nature of sexuality is something that is not talked about or understood well at all, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Another thing that I'm thinking in terms of a practical understanding of how do I only give myself to my spouse, Jack, I think you would agree, doesn't only mean that I don't have sex with another person. I don't have intercourse with another person out there. I don't share myself sexually in that way. I also don't share my mind sexually. What I mean by that is I'm not just saying I'm not having intercourse with anyone else, but I'm not reviewing pornography. I'm not indulging myself in fantasy. I'm not being a person who is actively involved, even in my mind, in bringing another man or woman into my mind. I am, obviously, those thoughts, those tendencies, those temptations come up for us. They come up for everybody. But what do I do with them is really important. Can we talk about that just a little bit? What's your perspective?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, one of the most horrible things that ever happened in our culture is the whole Playboy magazine culture and the attitude that lies behind that. It just always astounded me when I became aware of marriages where the husband would have a subscription to Playboy magazine and the wife would know about that and not really particularly have a problem with it, or at least was not letting it be known that she had a problem with it. The attitude behind it being, well, this is just this innocent, innocent, innocuous looking at female bodies, and he's just enjoying female bodies, and as long as he doesn't touch, that's fine with me, or something like that. Again, that's a perversion of what our sexuality is. It's a perversion of what sexuality is all about. Sexuality is not about pleasure to be indulged in however I want to indulge in it. Granted, pleasure is a really important part of sexuality in its appropriate context, but to pursue pleasure in and through sexual means anytime and anywhere I want to is in violation of its purpose. It seems to me that a righteous attitude towards sexuality is to understand and accept and acknowledge and rejoice in the fact that the purpose of my sexuality is to be this language that I'm going to use in communication with my wife. And that's it. That's why it's there. That's what I'm going to use it for. That's the only thing I'm going to use it for. To allow any other employment of my sexuality, I would say, is a perversion.
Period.
Period. Yeah.
Nothing else. Right. And that's a work that we have to invest ourselves in. It isn't something that comes naturally, particularly in our culture it doesn't, because we're taught and we see things from all around again that tell us that's not true.
Right.
So it's a work to discipline ourselves to go in that direction. Jack, I'm really glad that you brought up the whole area of pleasure, sexual pleasure, because as I'm looking back over the hour, we've really talked about sexuality as being a way to communicate my sexual, sex as a way to communicate my marital commitment to my spouse. It kind of sounds academic, it kind of sounds dry. We don't intend for it to be that way, and certainly pleasure is a big piece, and the joy of the intimacy between us is huge in sexuality. So in our discussions, I think certainly we need to bring that in, even as we're trying to understand things, a theory of sexuality.
Right, and we'll talk more about that as we proceed, both the right place for pleasure and the wrong place for pleasure, but yeah.
So again, how do I communicate that my spouse is special through sexual intimacy? Well, one way I do it is not bringing in pornography, not bringing in fantasy, not bringing in anything even in my mind. Now, men often will bring those kinds of things in, especially fantasy and pornography. I think women certainly do too. But I think something that is important to mention here before our time is up is that oftentimes a woman will just engage in sex without bringing herself there. She'll just do it because that's something she's just going to do because that's what her husband wants. But part of being sexual, part of communicating that you're special, is being present with you. And I would really encourage women to think about this. I wish we had more time right now. But very often women will just dissociate, just be bored, just get it over with. And that is not communicating what God intended sexuality to communicate. And it isn't being vulnerable. It isn't bringing me to the sexual relationship any more than a man who brings a pornographic scene in his mind to the sexual relationship. They're both wrong. Neither of them are helping me move toward a greater intimacy with my husband or wife.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that more in the future because I think that's important.
This program is produced by the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. The McKenzie Study Center was established in 1979 as a campus ministry near the University of Oregon. Since its beginning, it has focused its attention on encouraging, assisting, and equipping Christians with the tools to understand the Bible. The Study Center's staff believes that a clear understanding of God's Word is not merely an intellectual exercise, but the truth of the Bible is a radical message that every human being must understand. Central to the ministry is the thorough examination of our deep ingrained brokenness and rebellion against God. Consequently, understanding our desperate need for God's grace and mercy is also important to the Study Center ministry. McKenzie offers classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. The heart of the Study Center teaching ministry is the Tuesday night lectures. One of our classic Tuesday lecture series is Dr. Jack Crabtree's exposition of the Book of Romans. Other topics include marriage and sexuality, biblical interpretation, modern challenges to Christianity, and of course, the radical nature of the gospel. The Study Center also has numerous articles which may help many in their growth as Christians. For example, in her article, Pain and Glory, staff member Nancy Scott reveals her struggles with God when her mother was severely disabled with a major stroke, and what she learned from her mother's suffering, as well as her own. Or the article, In Praise of Manna, in which Dr. Crabtree examines Deuteronomy chapter 8 and the story of the manna in the wilderness as an illustration of how God uses suffering to humble his servants so they do not live for earthly delights, but rather the promises of God. All of the lectures and articles are available. Listen at the end of the program for information on how you can order tapes, articles, or a copy of this program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
To review briefly what we've been talking about then, we talked about how different a biblical worldview is when it comes to sexuality from the worldview that you would find prevalent in our culture. Our culture would argue or would assume that marriage is something that we as human beings have created to harness and control this sexuality that has been given us by evolution. The biblical worldview is that God has designed marriage and has given it a shape and a design and a purpose. It's not something that man invented. Marriage is something that God invented. And whereas our culture would see sexuality as the given and marriage as something that man has created to harness sexuality, in God's design, God created human beings to be married to one another, a man and woman to be married to one another, and created them sexual beings in order to help give them a tool to use in sealing and celebrating and communicating the marriage commitment to one another. So in other words, sexuality only has its meaning in relationship to marriage rather than marriage having its relationship, having its meaning in relationship to sexuality. So that raised the question, of course, well then what role does sexuality play in relationship to the marriage commitment? And what I argued is that God has just so constructed the human psyche that sexual intimacy with another person automatically means something. Whether we like it or not, when I give my body to another person in sexual intimacy, I am saying to that person, I'm giving you myself. I'm giving you my entire life. Everything that is mine is yours. I am going to be loyal to you. You are going to be special to me. And I am going to spend the rest of my life coming to know you and connecting with you and becoming one flesh with you. Whether we like it or not, sexual intimacy is making that promise to the other person. If I'm right about that, and I think I am, if I'm right about that, then it explains why, from a biblical point of view, the only place where sexual intimacy is appropriate is in the context of a marriage commitment, where what we are doing with our lives is, in fact, carrying out and fulfilling the promise that we are making with our bodies. In any other context, if I am intimate with someone sexually, I'm lying to them, I'm deceiving them. I'm saying one thing with my body and then turning away and never fulfilling my promise.
And Jack, we said that this understanding of sexuality is not something that comes naturally to us because our culture teaches us something very, very different. Our culture teaches us that sexuality is a very casual thing. It really is not, in our culture, an expression of me, of my vulnerability, of myself. And so for people to really understand what we're talking about, they and we really have to turn off our culture, in a sense, and really focus on the biblical understanding of sexuality. It is something that is very unique to me. It is a giving of my whole being. And if I'm giving my being to you, I must then forgo things like pornography, like not bringing myself into sexuality, into my sexual experience, like other partners in my marriage. I need to bring myself to you and do it wholeheartedly.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.